High Liberty, Chapter 13. He rode into the stable yard at Featherfront and slid off his horse. For a moment he leaned against it, his forehead against the damp, warm withers, wondering. It seemed to come to him only then, just where he was, what had happened. His knees buckled under the weight and the shock of it. He shook himself like a spaniel and set his jaw, pressed himself away from the horse and ran into the house by the back, through the kitchen. Faithful old Johnson, grizzled now and broader than ever, ran to him, full of mute signals and semaphores, her heavy face urgent and anxious. But he thrust her aside and bound up the covered stairs.
"If he's sleeping, by God, I'll twitch him on to the floor."
But the old man's eyes were opened and pensive, one eyebrow cocked in that comforting, "What's this, I can handle it," expression, and Lance almost cried out with relief.
"She's back, sir, the Duchess, and it's all smashed. She's been to Ickworth to see Bristol, and she got away with the Kingston title and property, and none of it worked, none of it, not even Meadows' damned inheritance."
He stopped and stood gasping and demanding. Berrabridge lay silent, not looking at Lance, but still at the door, with that quizzical eyebrow and the bright, bright eyes.
"Damn it, there's nothing left. We are... "Mr. Berrabridge?"
he asked softly.
"Sir?"
he whispered, bending close. Mr. Berrabridge did not move. Mr. Berrabridge did not speak. Mr. Berrabridge was, in fact, dead. Lance slammed his fists unmercifully against his own eyes and loosed a great, agonized cry, and amidst the dots and splashes of painful, speckled light from the blows, he backed away to the door, turned, and plunged down the stairs. In a boiling jumble of anguish, he thought as he ran, "It's all gone, and I never had a mother to run to. Pickett was my mother, Berrabridge was my mother, and a bed's a great mother's breast to cry on and feed me." Across the great hall, and a shin-hungry chair, rung ringing to clatter and break and to spin him grunting to the window, to fall there a-gasping and gripping and ripping the drape, cough in the dusty folds of it, fight them away, and knee up and stumble and knee up again and go banging to the bed to hide.
"Captain Courtney, how nice!"
in clear, sweet syllables, each a true half-tone lower than the one before, and there in the bed he so needed, sat Lilith Axelrude, with her back to the bolster at the headboard, and a white scarf arranged round her shoulders, and her heavy hair arranged on the white silk. Lance rocked in the doorway until he was able to raise one arm and point at her. His lungs filled and emptied with pain at the extremes, and when he tried to speak, his lips disobeyed, and pursed, so that he half-whistled, half-wheezed, a Berrabridge kind of noise. He stood insane in the doorway, pointing like that, wheezing, and then began to come across the room toward her, the one hand still pointing, the other forgotten, legs striding wide apart like a sailor's in a hurricane.
"Lance!"
she coquetted, holding out her arms to him, and
"Lance!"
she cried in alarm. The next time she cried out, it was not a word at all. He struck her like a charge of grapeshot, everywhere. He snapped, he struck, he flopped like a banked trout. Warding him off was impossible, so she threw slim steel arms around him and held him tighter and tighter and tighter until she held him almost still. He was far stronger, but she could do it because he was utterly out of control. His fighting became a shuddering, and the shudder something else. Still he punished her. He flogged the wide world and all life and effort. But he was met in this. He flashed upward like a gusted gull. He stood over the world like a mountain, spread over it like a cloud, and the shudder again, now a shiver, now still. She held him tightly, but not altogether to protect herself. She pulled her head a little distance away to see him better, and said tremulously,
"Lance, you hurt me, Lance?"
The sound of her voice struck the flames in him like a flung bowl of brandy, and they exploded. It was as violent as before, and as he punished the world and her, he punished himself in his stupidity, at his dreams for being stupid, and his acts for being stupid. He cut and slashed at the stupid thing of being alive until abruptly he was spent. He could not draw breath then for a painful time, and when he could, he expelled it in a woeful wail, and dropped his face into the hollow of her neck and shoulder, and cried. He baaed like a sheep, baaed, while she held him tight again, frightened. Then he escaped finally, and he was asleep. In his sleep, he called from far away,
"Elaine!"
Asleep, he sat up in panic, eyes wide, and shouted,
"Elaine!"
Soft arms put him down, and a soft hand covered his eyes until they closed. Softly, he sniffled, and twice there was an infantile, past misery catch in his breath. He burrowed close, snug, snug and close, and slept quietly. He awoke in the black dark, and far away there was a point of light which, if he came close enough, might be an opening through which he could look. He blinked hard to make it come clear, and suddenly it did, and was a candle across the room. He watched it for a time, pleased with it. Under his cheek was something more firm, more smooth than a pillow, and down from his chin to the edge of the bed a column lay. He raised his head to see, and under his cheek was a hand, and the column was an arm, and up from the edge of the bed came hair and the face of Lilith Axelrod. She stood on the floor by the bed, and perhaps she had been sleeping there, but she had kept her hand under his face so that she would know when he awoke. He looked at her in silent amazement. She straightened up and bent over him, so that her hair fell over both their faces like a magic tent, and she said in a tone he had never heard before, that he would have believed impossible to a human throat, so soft and full and intense. It was,
"Oh, I love you so."
And when he opened his mouth to answer, she dropped her lips to it. With an illimitable tenderness he surely would have missed had he not been too weak to move. She slipped away from him, and was back in three heartbeats, with the thick earthen bowl of broth which had stood covered on the tabouret. She set it on the floor and removed the cover, and took the broken bread and dipped it and put it to his lips. He took it slowly, watching her face the whole time. When it was about half finished, he shook his head slightly, and she put it by, staying where she was, just to watch him live.
"Lilith Axelrod," he said.
"Lance."
She stroked his face. He fell asleep again. When she was sure, she rose carefully, crossed the room on tiptoe, and blew out the candle.
Lance went out and walked to the footbridge, and stood looking down at the water, quarrelling about the pebbles below. He could not believe the morning, and he did not remember the night, and he knew he must and would. What was this madness about marriage? Who had spoken of it first? On impulse he crossed the bridge, and stepped down the bank,
and knelt to dash the clear, bubbly water into his face. Talk, talk, talk with Lilith, and it was a haze until now, but now it came, not in order, but clearly enough.
"I have all the Kingston properties in England. They're mine," she had said. And, I didn't know I'd love you. I didn't know love."
"Oh, yes," and,
"I came here for her because she wanted to know just what you were going to do next. I was to dazzle you and find out. But, Lance, I didn't know this would happen."
"That's right, that's right." And she had said, too, that she had the Duchess's permission to leave her service, but that if she did, the Duchess would punish her.
"I don't know how. I wouldn't know until it happened. She says I may go, but she doesn't want me to. Not really."
"And what was that about the last time?"
"I couldn't forget you. I wanted to, but I couldn't. It wasn't like this. It was just a glow that wouldn't go away. Remember, Lance, what I said about wanting only to find out about how high is high? This is high enough, my darling dear. I want no more, ever again, than this."
Somewhere in the mid-morning there returned his daily man, woeful adjutant to the slow parade he led. The doctor's black rig bearing the priest, and a wagon with three laborers, and a coffin for Mr. Barrowbridge, all summoned at dawn from Tatsfield. Lilith had said,
"The Duchess said he was here, but we couldn't find out. Lance, you loved him, didn't you?"
They put him to sleep beside old Piggott in a little burial ground which had not been used for 3 centuries. When the priest said the right words, old Johnson said the real ones, without words. Lance, suddenly overcome, watching the spades full of earth showering down, said in an anguished voice within him,
"Oh, Piggott, if you forgive me, I will—"
and it was never finished. It tore him, which he could ill afford, and he returned to the house, and Lilith, who held him until he could talk again. And the talk came round again to marriage. Who talked of it first? He didn't know. Well, what did it matter who first?
"This time yesterday I'd have wangled to marry you or not, Lance, whichever suited me, and it wouldn't have suited me. Now, oh, my darling!"
"I have nothing. I shall never have anything of my own,"
he had cried suddenly, remembering, and she had laughed and kissed him in the new tender way he had just learned was possible.
"What's mine is yours, beloved. What's getting as long as you get? What's having as long as you have? Wouldn't you have wanted the Kingston holdings? Then why not just take them from me?"
How was he to trust her? But surely, though she had words and words, could she counterfeit that light in her eyes, that never before tone in her voice? And hadn't she said,
"Decide, Lance, a clear decision. If it's no, promise. Oh, promise to see me whenever you can. Or don't promise that, just say no. But say yes, yes, if you can. Even if you almost can, I'll make up the difference for you, you'll see."
But what about Elaine? He had kissed Elaine once, and virtually the same thing had happened. But it had happened to both of them, whereas here only Lilith was affected. He might be, but he wasn't now, or at least wasn't yet. He shook his head, confused. Lilith was away at noon, gone up to London to see Beasley, and perhaps the Duchess. She would be back tonight, or tomorrow. Once upon a time there was a prince, and he was invisible, and the wicked old witch was banished, and he took all the lands and castles, and everybody could see him. How do you kiss a wish?
"Mr. Barrowbridge!"
he yelled at the top of his voice. Johnson popped out of the kitchen door and looked at him, wringing her hands.
"What shall I do, sir?" Lance whispered.
The brook bubbled and the birds sang. Somebody said something about a moth in a room of 1,000 lights, safe on a cold candle. Years back in his mind, somebody said something about a libertine.
"Aye, libertine," murmured Lance Courtney, "being of sound mind and clear faculties, do hereby depose and declare that all my life has been a grind and a climb, that in spite of how I might seem to the chaps in the city who think I am a young gentleman of leisure, or to Johnson, to whom I am but a power which comes and goes in mystery, or to Lilith, who loves me, or to Elaine Eustace, whom I love with all my heart, or to Barrowbridge, to whom I could have been but an ingenious incompetent, or to Piggott, to whom I was a serpent, or to Meadows, who calls me a philanthropist, or Hetzibah, who calls me a godling and a genius." His eyes began to sting, and he closed them, and bowed his head, and breathed with difficulty. "Or to my mother," he whispered, "who wants me the way I am more than she wants my death. I therefore hereby, and whereas," he choked and shook himself, "do now and forever forswear the paths into which I am pushed, and choose those by which I shall profit, and the colour of that profit shall be that for which I have been starved all my life, my pleasure. And because never in my life have I had life's permission to develop the taste for simple pleasures, I shall pursue dark ones. And the darkest direction for me now is to marry a woman of great property who loves me, and through her and her property to pursue by falsehood and chicanery and insincerity the Courtney crest. I shall kill if I must get it. I shall not regard it as a triumph unless I trample the innocents to get it. Slander and slaughter and destroy, all of this I shall enjoy. So never again will life, or Elizabeth, Duchess of Kingston, stay me. There is nothing more she can do to me. She has done it all. Never again will the idea of destiny tempt me. No fortune unwrought by a man himself is to be trusted. A man makes his own fortune. I have fought and striven all my life for the simple thing of having a decent man call me a decent man. Just that. And since destiny has never had that for me, I'll have no more to do with destiny. Hereafter, then, let it be Lilith and the libertine. I shall make her very happy, and the rest of the world afraid.
It grew dark and late. Lily had gone up to town unattended. He should have got someone to go with her. He hoped she had secured someone to come back. He ate a cold mutton sandwich, and changed his shirt for a better one, and changed his boots twice. He tried to read, and tried to write Meadows, to explain matters. When the rider clumped into the stable-yard, he whipped a comb through his side hair, ran to the door, and flung it open at the first sounds of footsteps outside.
"Yes, darling, yes!" he cried.
"Righto! What, what?"
said Sir Gregory Eustace, blinking out of the dark.
"Courtney, I say, good evening, what?"
"Oh, sir, I do beg your pardon," said Lance, overcome.
He pulled himself together.
"Come in, sir, come in. I was, expecting, you know, someone else."
"Well, I'd say so. Yes, darling, what?"
"Oh, yes," said Lance. "T.D., darling, you know. Holcombe Barrister. Nice chap."
"Nice chap, yes. Don't know him," said Sir Gregory.
He stood in the middle of the great hall while Lance got out the port.
"What can I do for you, sir?"
"Like old times, what? Except, an apology.
Apology? I? Sir Gregory, what on earth?
The way I acted, in the city, shaking Jollywell fist. That sort of rot.
Nance recalled now that awful moment when the yellow carriage met him, Elaine running toward him in some sort of distress. At the corner, the small angry figure of the baronet.
Why, sir, I noticed nothing.
Decent of you, but, ha, I must confess. Very angry. Book, you know. Gibbons, decline and fall. Blamed you.
You were angry at me because of the book?
The way you handed it over. Source book. Ha! Blooming masterpiece. Never do anything like it in 3 lifetimes. All my work, up the spout, what? Years. Thought you were making a fool of me.
My dear Sir Gregory, I didn't read a blessed thing into the book but the title. I heard it was good, and that is all.
Yes, thought of that later. Upset, you know. Forbade Elaine to speak to you. Ha! Defined me. See that? Right on the London street. What? Lots of pepper, that girl.
He raised his glass.
Cheers.
Cheerio. I'm terribly sorry if the book...
Not at all, old chap. Good of you. Well, I'm Pop. Very, very decent of you. Good night.
Lance saw him to the door.
Good night, sir.
Start on something else new now. Blessed if I know. What? What? Good night. Very decent of you, old chap.
Good night, sir.
He held the door open and looked out into the blackness, hearing a dwindling mutter around the stable.
Decent of you. Decent. Awfully decent. What a decent chap.
It grew really late, and Lance's worry reached a peak and passed it.
If she is not here by 10, he thought, then she'll stay over and be here tomorrow.
As he concluded this, he heard the hoofbeats outside. He ran to the door and snatched it open, at the first step, saying nothing at all. And a good thing, too, it was a dusty footman. Haynes, of Blanton House.
Ah, good evening, Haynes.
Evening, sir. A letter for you.
Lance took the letter curiously. It bore his name, nothing else on the outside, and was sealed without a signet. He left it on the hall table and brought Haynes a shilling and a spot of brandy.
"Thank ye, sir,"
said the man, and with simultaneous motions threw the brandy down his throat and the shilling into his pocket. He saluted and left. Lance took the letter to an easy chair and sat down with his back to 2 candles. Something told him he must settle himself and take this at ease. He opened it and grunted.
"Lilith,"
he read.
"My very darling, I must say what I have to say briefly and quickly, or never at all. I have told the Duchess that we would marry if it suited you. She said immediately that we must not. I'm afraid I rather lost my head at that, but now I confess she is right. Her reason, and this is exactly what she said, if you marry him, I shall tell you who your mother is. Lance, I can't tell you what she means. I don't know. I have known her all my life. I have not known anything of my parents, and, darling, it does not matter whether or not her horrid suggestion is true. She would use it. You know she would. I told you she would punish me because I wanted to leave her, and you know how far she will go to punish you. There is nothing we can do, my darling. She has won again, as she always wins. I was free to come to you and tell you, but I dare not. I shall remain in England. She is keeping her promise about the Kingston lands here, but I mistrust it. Doubtless she will let it all revert to the meadows when she dies. I have earned her hatred, and I think she would express it so. Beloved, oh, my beloved, go to Elaine, be happy with her. High enough is, high enough, my dear. Your own Lilith. P.S. If you think of me as a sister, then at least you may love me a little."
There was a spatter of tears across the shaky postscript. Slowly, Lance lowered the letter to his knee and bowed his head. Strike Elizabeth Chudley with a zephyr, and she'll respond with a hurricane. Lilith. Lilith. Lilith was the devil's brother. Who the devil had told her about Elaine? I, Elaine? Oh, no, said Lance aloud. As he said it, madness trickled out of him like a dark fluid and lay all about him before it evaporated spiritously, leaving of itself no trace, and he saw the meaning of that pleasure which had eluded him all his life. He had striven for what Barrowbridge felt he should have so hard that when fortune handed him a silver platter piled with happy fruits, he was suspicious even of the platter, and especially of the donor. He had taken as his own the revenge of an old man, confusing it with the bright, dark desire to be a libertine, a devil, if you like, that lives in all men. And after all, there had been Lilith. But when he demanded of himself, "Were you ever something that you wanted to be? When did you strive for something because you wanted it? Where is the one thing you have ever found that you wanted?" Unaccountably, he felt wonderful, marvelous. He closed his eyes and looked at tomorrow and made a wish. He kissed the wish. The end. Afterwards. The story of Elizabeth Chudley is substantially true. She was and she did all the things herein described. She was undoubtedly an extraordinary woman. Perhaps it would be of interest to the reader to know what happened to her afterwards. She left England in 1776, after having been found guilty at the trial by the House of Lords, and never returned. She finally repaired to St. Petersburg, where she became fast friends with Catherine the Great. There she built a fabulous estate, calling it Chudley. Catherine was 9 years her junior, specifically 50 to the Duchess's 59. And one of the most intriguing of the conjectures is the nature of the reminiscences these two colorful old biddies must have shared over their tea. Elizabeth, Duchess of Kingston, died in 1788 at the age of 68, and the title died with her. The estate did indeed go to Charles Meadows, a nephew of the Duke, though Evelyn Meadows, who had brought the suit for bigamy, was still alive. These odds and ends might be of interest to you, too, as they were to me. The suit for jactitation of marriage had descended to the common law and is a legitimate action, though still extremely rare. It was not until 1835 that consanguineous marriages in England became automatically void. Before that, they were voidable, but quite binding, and valid until voided. The Earldom of Devon, which died in Padua in 1556 in the person of Edward Courtney, was twice gained and lost, once by a Blount and once by a Cavendish. In 1831, one William Courtney, a respected clerk of Parliament, equipped with a far-reaching genealogy and the fact of omission of the de corpore suo clause in the ancient Courtney patent, that is to say, technically, succession need not follow from the Duke's issue, but was allowable from a collateral, actually succeeded in reviving the title, and it does still exist. The author urges historically-minded sharpshooters to draw their beads on this narrative and wishes them good hunting. They will find certain licenses in my libertine. As a small example, the unseasonably warm weather when everyone knows Elizabeth's suit for jactitation took place in February 1769, and more power to them. When they are done, let them proceed to Aesop and delete everything they find there about talking animals. In short, this is a fable, written by and for the dilettante of the fabulous. It was extraordinarily easy and pleasant to write, and it is hoped that it is correspondingly easy and pleasant to read. Acknowledgement must be made to those without whom the book and the author surely never would have been known at all. First, there is Mr. T. H. White, whose Age of Scandal served up Elizabeth Chudley hot and crackling in her transparent gown. Mr. Theodore Sturgeon assisted nobly with the research. Mr. Gene Shepherd pushed and pushed at the author until he was, in the world of books, born. And last mentioned, but first of all, the Night People, whose battle cry is Excelsior, and whose humor and forbearance are really responsible for this work. We hope that you have enjoyed our presentation of I, Libertine, by Frederick R. Ewing. Book copyright 1956 by Frederick R. Ewing. Read by James Campanella. Directed by Eileen Swanson. Engineered by Peter Hasbro. Produced by Arthur Guthrie Jr. Podcast by John Smalley. Performance copyright 2006 by Uvula Audio. All rights reserved. For other Uvula Audio titles, please go to our website at www.uvulaaudio.com.